welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working from home on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, March 4th, 2021. The new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations calls on South Sudanese leaders to get serious.
We see the situation in South Sudan as precarious. We are worried about the slow pace of the peace process and the levels of violence, and we believe UNMISS has a critical role to play.
And Sudan receives thousands of vaccine doses from COVAX.
This is a global coordination. As you know, the COVAX facility where 92 countries, middle and low income countries, are receiving support.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations is calling on South Sudanese leaders to expedite the implementation of the 2018 peace agreement, address rampant intercommunal violence in parts of South Sudan, and give humanitarian workers access to reach vulnerable South Sudanese dealing with violence and hunger. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who assumed the presidency of the UN Security Council Wednesday, says South Sudan's 2018 peace agreement remains fragile. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio reports from Washington.
This is a global coordination. As you know, the COVAX facility where 92 countries, middle and low income countries, are receiving support from Gavi, CEPI, WHO and UNICEF, of course, with support from donor countries, funding so that every country in the world receives a vaccine. As you very much know, many countries have not been receiving, and most of the vaccine in the world today actually was done, or most vaccinations were done in most developed countries. So this is the first time I think a global effort is done where COVID vaccine now is going to be available to also lower and middle income countries. So all of us have worked together over the last 12 weeks, government of Sudan, World Health Organization, UNICEF in Sudan, working along with our colleagues in Gavi, CEPI, to arrive at this day where Sudan has received the first portion of its 2.9 million doses expected until May.
800,000 doses in a country of 45 million people, that's a very small number. How do you prioritize who gets it first?
There is actually a national vaccine plan where the first priority, of course, is healthcare workers, those who are working in isolation centers, those who are working at hospitals. So the 828,000 will cover about 414,000. Sudan has prioritized, as I said, healthcare workers first, and then those who are above certain age with chronic diseases or work with what we call comorbidities. So that's the prioritization.
And a note of clarification here, we're talking about the AstraZeneca vaccine, which means for one person to be fully vaccinated, they require two doses, two shots in the arm. Is that correct?
Correct. Correct. That's why 828,000 will give you 414,000 people.
Sudan seems to be the first country in the MENA region, that's Middle East and North Africa, to receive COVID-19 vaccines. Why does Sudan rank high in priority? Tell me a little bit about the numbers as of today with regards to COVID-19 cases in Sudan and how they compare to the region.
Sudan is the first country in the MENA region to have received vaccines through the COVAX facility. Other countries who are actually self-financing have purchased or done it through their other means. But through the COVAX facility, we are the first country to receive in this way. Of course, Sudan has witnessed already the second wave of COVID. Over the last few days, actually, we've had cases, a few hundreds, across the entire country. We had few deaths and few recoveries. I don't have the exact figures now in front of me, but overall, the figures have stayed relatively stable. We are, of course, afraid that a third wave may hit us, and that's why I think it's essential, at least the healthcare system in Sudan, should be in a position where it does not close again like it happened the first time.
Well, the data shows here that as of March 1st, 2021, Sudan registered 28,505 confirmed COVID-19 cases and around 1,892 deaths. And these numbers would suggest a lack of strict adherence to COVID-19 preventive measures in Sudan. And for various reasons, cultural, social, economic, etc. But my question to you is, there is a lot of skepticism about the vaccine around the world, and Sudan is no exception. How do you navigate this situation? How do you get people convinced that they should take the vaccine?
Actually, that's an excellent question, and I'm glad you mentioned that this is a global phenomenon, and Sudan is not an exception. Actually, we have, with the government, there are 9 subcommittees, part of the national system, that is working to address issues of risk communication. So confronting, you know, misinformation about vaccine, confronting and actually educating the public about the benefits of the vaccine, indicating the safety of the vaccine, and again, all of the vaccines. We're not advocating for any specific vaccines, but also the efficacy and the of vaccines. So all of this is being done through communication, through social media, through TV, through print, and also through community engagement. So there is a group called Communication for Development that UNICEF has, that is working closely with the health promotion of the Ministry of Health, as well as WHO and other partners.
Beside the vaccine, what other tools are you using to fight the virus in Sudan?
Well, public information, awareness, the provision of masks in some school settings and for children and teachers. We're providing with the government PPEs, protective equipment, masks, the uniform for hospital workers. We're actually funding also isolation centers. We're providing oxygen concentrators. All of these are part of the effort UNICEF is doing, undertaking to support the national system. And of course, the first time when the initial closure happened and many families not beyond the in their local work employment, we supported the government to provide provision of cash for hundreds of thousands of families, along with World Food Program and others and UNHCR, so that families who could not continue to their employment could at least get some support while they were stuck at home for a number of weeks.
Conflict over land could soon become South Sudan's new problem. Sandra Tombe, a PhD candidate at George Mason University's School for Peace and Conflict Resolution, says structural violence can last for generations because of its effects on the affected communities. She says authorities in South Sudan should not ignore land-related problems.
Juba in particular, I think, is an interesting place because it's the capital, right? And as a you know, as a country or as a state, everyone should be able to be in the capital, right? And at the same time, to your point about people coming in and Juba or Central Equatorial State being the only place where people are engaging in land grabbing, to address that conflict, then you would want to ease some of the pressures that have led people to flee into Juba, into Central Equatoria. And that means making sure that, you know, people who came from the government basically needs to ensure that people are able to return to the places where they had to flee because of, you know, flooding or because of conflict and all of that. So you have to secure a space for people to be able to return home and to build or rebuild the space where they used to live. And also making sure that you acknowledge communities that are making sacrifices to host individuals who move because of conflict or who are forced to move because of conflict, and to not abuse that, I think.
Let us talk about the dangers of a conflict that is embedded in the fabric of the society. A clear example is what is happening in Central Equatoria. It appears that land is very dear to the Bari community in Central Equatoria. So what are some of the dangers of structural conflict?
The dangers of structural conflict is that it, at some point, it continues without us knowing why we're still fighting. It becomes embedded in the system that future generations, we tend to hear stories about what happened to our, you know, ancestors or grandparents, and we tend to continue that because it's a problem that if it's structural and if it was never addressed at its root, then it tends to continue to divide people without future generations really having an understanding of why is it that I'm divided or I'm separate from this particular community or this group of people. So structural conflicts tend to be things that are deeply rooted, and because they're deeply rooted, their solution has to be integrative, has to be, you have to have a systemic approach to addressing them. So you can't address one aspect of them without really taking a 360 look of what are the dimensions of this particular conflict and how might we resolve it in a way that addresses kind of its foundations.
I have a lot of friends and colleagues, you know, dating back to my school days in Juba. Some of them who don't come from Central Equatoria normally tell me, hey, can you talk to your people to really allow us to rent houses in Juba? Because it appears like some communities are finding it very difficult to rent a house in Juba. I know that you are not an expert on land issues, but there is a conflict here related to land. How do we go about it?
So I think this is where we see the symptoms of the actual conflict, right? And I think that's where it's not about what region you come from, but it's about really how communities are divided and the fact that it's Equatoria or it's somewhere else. I think that's secondary to the issue that there is communal divisions and communal prejudices that are affecting how I might rent to someone who's Equatorian or who's non-Equatorian based on who I am or based on how I perceive this identity and what I perceive these particular people to do when you rent them a space, for example, or when they work next to you or when they live next to you, what is it that they tend to do? So I think our issue is the land is, I think, secondary in terms of really exposing the divisions that exist within South Sudan. I agree with you. I think, again, because of Juba serving as the capital as well, you can't say as a South Sudanese, you cannot live here or you cannot... people should be able to rent a space, right, and to live in Juba. But again, it's about how equitable and how fairly are people able to buy property? What are the legal mechanisms and systems that people are using to be able to acquire land?
Talking about symptoms of conflict, stereotype and assumption, some of the symptoms of conflict. And, you know, between me and you, and that has fractured our society because, for instance, if an individual from Area X lived with you and was very violent and does not understand, you know, common sense, it doesn't mean everybody from that community is violent. And so apart from these assumptions, what would you list as some of the problems sparking conflicts among South Sudanese?
By far, the biggest problem is the politicization of identity. And there's a lot of countries that have a lot of ethnic diversity, linguistic diversity, and that is by itself, it's not a cause of conflict, right? And I think what we see in South Sudan is that those identities are being mobilized for political purposes. So the vast majority of those who, you know, kind of thinking about people always associate Dinka with SPLMIG and associate Nuer with SPLMIO. And I think that's really misattributing the divisions that exist and that those identities, the vast majority of individuals from these communities are not direct beneficiaries of the political system that we have in South Sudan, but their identities have been used in that purpose, you know? And arguably that's also the case in Equatoria, that those identities are mobilizable and that's what political actors do, especially in spaces like South Sudan where you have a weak state and the only way to leverage your power over the other is to kind of divide people in that way. And so I think if society could separate itself from politics, which I know it's not something that it could easily do, right? Because I think they feed off of one another. If that separation could be possible, then I think people could see that, you know, you could separate the political from the personal, from the social, and hopefully that would kind of create more bridges between different communities.
That's Sandra Thombe, a PhD candidate at George Mason University's School for Peace and Conflict Resolution. She spoke with me this week from Washington. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Sudanese start work on a new constitution. Stay tuned for that story right after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how many languages do you speak fluently?
I have a minimum of 5 languages. I speak my mother tongue, that is one. 2, I speak English, I speak Luganda, I speak Swahili, I speak Acholi.
I speak 5 languages, that is the Kakwa language, Lugbarati language, I speak English, and of course Kiswahili and the Lunyoro language. Those are the main languages that I speak fluently.
There are 2, English and Kinyarwanda. Because sometimes I feel like when I'm with this person, I can be able to speak with him or her fluently. And when I'm with that one, I can't be able to speak fluently.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. A group of Sudanese civil society activists have begun grassroots consultations on Sudan's permanent constitution. The activists are urging the transitional government to open up and demonstrate a genuine commitment towards transforming the country to a democratic state. For VOA News, Michael Atit has more on the story from the capital, Khartoum.
More than 30 civil society groups team up to revamp what they called the Sudanese Initiative for Constitutional Making Process, an initiative that began in 2011 but was interrupted a few years later by former President Omar al-Bashir's security agents. Speaking to reporters at the state-owned Sudan News Agency building in Khartoum earlier this week, Awadelkarim Fadlalmola, a member of the initiative, says the Sudanese revolution has given activists renewed hope to continue consultation and engage all Sudanese in writing the country's permanent constitution. He believes the repeated failure by the government to include the Sudanese people in writing several constitutions since Sudan's gained independence in 1956 has contributed to lack of equal opportunities for many Sudanese and created imbalances in service delivery.
For the first time in our history, citizens will have an opportunity to participate in the process with their visions, thoughts, intentions, and ambitions. They are able to write their own constitution with their hands. This is different from the previous constitutions that had been written by elites or academic intellectuals or politicians. Now citizens will write a constitution that reflects their ambitions.
Fadlalmola says activists will be organizing workshops, seminars, training sessions with traditional and religious leaders, youth, women, farmers, cattle keepers, and other groups to enlighten them about the importance of their participation in crafting the constitution which will define the future of the country and allow services to reach all corners of the country without discrimination.
Through this initiative, we will strive to engage new partners and we will be opened up to all Sudanese citizens regardless of their sectors, cultures or class. All Sudanese people, including minorities, will all be partners to this constitution.
Fadlalmola says the current political environment is conducive for conducting nationwide consultations so that ordinary Sudanese can express their thoughts on what they want to see in the new permanent constitution. He is urging Sudanese to work together to define a new destiny for the country. Fadlalmola says people have suffered for far too long from wars and destruction.
When we all write a constitution, we will own it and defend it at all costs. This is a new phenomenon which will be added to culture and to the process of the constitutional making in Sudan. We expect this process to be more democratic than constitutions that have been written by elites or in closed door on behalf of the Sudanese citizens.
Fadlalmola called on the government officials to allow more freedoms in the country so that citizens can openly speak their minds. He also urges all political parties, rights groups, and intellectuals to contribute to the constitution-making process.
The initiative will open up new engagement despite many challenges that have been encountered during the previous government. It was not possible for many donors to give a hand and support issues in the country because the previous regime would think it could impact directly on the system.
Fadlan Mula calls the Juba peace deal a good step towards silencing the guns and allowing access to war-affected areas so that refugees and IDPs in those areas can also participate in the constitutional-making process. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Still in Sudan, authorities in Khartoum say they have received 828,000 doses of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine on Wednesday. Health authorities in Khartoum say the vaccines will be administered to health workers and elderly people. Sudan is the first country in the Middle East and North Africa region to receive the vaccine from the COVAX facility. Abdallah Fadil is UNICEF's country representative in Sudan, who coordinates efforts to acquire and distribute the vaccine in Sudan.
This is a global coordination. As you know, the COVAX facility where 92 countries, middle and low income countries, are receiving support from Gavi, CEPI, WHO, and UNICEF, of course, with support from donor countries, funding so that every country in the world receives a vaccine. As you very much know, many countries have not been receiving, and most of the vaccine in the world today actually was done, or most vaccinations were done in most developed countries. So this is the first time I think a global effort is done where COVID vaccine now is going to be available to also lower and middle income countries. So all of us have worked together over the last 12 weeks, government of Sudan, World Health Organization, UNICEF in Sudan, working along with our colleagues in Gavi and CEPI, to arrive at this day where Sudan has received the first portion of its 2.9 million doses expected until May.
800,000 doses in a country of 45 million people, that's a very small number. How do you prioritize who gets it first?
There is actually a national vaccine plan where the first priority, of course, is healthcare workers, those who are working in isolation centers, those who are working at hospitals. So the 828,000 will cover about 414,000. Sudan has prioritized, as I said, healthcare workers first, and then those who are above certain age with chronic diseases or work with what we call comorbidities. So that's the prioritization.
And a note of clarification here, we're talking about the AstraZeneca vaccine, which means for one person to be fully vaccinated, they require two doses, two shots in the arm. Is that correct?
Correct. That's why 828,000 will give you 414,000 people.
Sudan seems to be the first country in the MENA region, that's Middle East and North Africa, to receive COVID-19 vaccines. Why does Sudan rank high in priority? Tell me a little bit about the numbers as of today with regards to COVID-19 cases in Sudan and how they compare to the region.
Sudan is the first country in the MENA region to have received vaccines through the COVAX facility. Other countries who are actually self-financing have purchased or done it through their other means. But through the COVAX facility, we are the first country to receive in this way. Of course, Sudan has witnessed already the second wave of COVID. Over the last few days, actually, we've had cases, a few hundreds across the entire country. We had few deaths and few recoveries. I don't have the exact figures now in front of me, but overall, the figures have stayed relatively stable. We are, of course, afraid that a third wave may hit us, and that's why I think the essential, at least the healthcare system in Sudan, should be in a position where it does not close again like it happened the first time.
Well, the data shows here that as of March 1st, 2021, Sudan registered 28,505 confirmed COVID-19 cases, and around 1,892 deaths. And these numbers would suggest a lack of strict adherence to COVID-19 preventive measures in Sudan. And for various reasons, cultural, social, economic, etc. But my question to you is, there is a lot of skepticism about the vaccine around the world, and Sudan is no exception. How do you navigate this situation? How do you get people convinced that they should take the vaccine?
Actually, that's an excellent question, and I'm glad you mentioned that this is a global phenomenon, and Sudan is not an exception. Actually, we have, with the government, there are 9 subcommittees, part of the national system, that is working to address issues of risk communication. So confronting, misinformation about vaccine, confronting and actually educating the public about the benefits of the vaccine, indicating the safety of the vaccine, and again, all of the vaccines. We're not advocating for any specific vaccines, but also the efficacy and the of vaccines. So all of this is being done through communication, through social media, through TV, through print, and also through community engagement. So there is a group called Communication for Development that UNICEF has, that is working closely with the health promotion of the Ministry of Health, as well as WHO and other partners.
Beside the vaccine, what other tools are you using to fight the virus in Sudan?
Well, public information, awareness, the provision of masks in some school settings and for children and teachers. We're providing with the government PPEs, protective equipment, masks, the uniform for hospital workers. We're actually funding also isolation centers. We're providing oxygen concentrators. All of these are part of the effort UNICEF is doing, undertaking to support the national system. And of course, the first time when the initial closure happened and many families could not be on the in their local work employment, we supported the government to provide provision of cash for hundreds of thousands of families, along with World Food Program and others and UNHCR, so that families who could not continue to their employment could at least get some support while they were stuck at home for a number of weeks.
That's Abdallah Fadil, UNICEF's country representative in Sudan. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biajo here in Washington. We love to hear what you think about this show. Send us your brief comments to our WhatsApp number, +12026308011. We'll air comments every Friday. That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Shane by Jalad.
أخبار وخشن يسمو مستواتي تسأل شن الحب فيه
والحب في ذاته مبرر كافي ما شين ودشن هالسيا في شين شين ودشن كلمة ما في
شين نقع خراب ما في
We've been listening to Jalad with the song Shane. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
بيني الليل ما بيني
الجسم عظيم يا بمرور